In many Caribbean homes, childhood did not end when harm happened. It simply went quiet. Girls learned early which questions not to ask and which memories to bury. Pain was renamed discipline. Fear was called respect. Silence was framed as strength, and endurance became proof of love. We rarely asked what that silence cost. We praised resilience without listening to what created it. We told girls to be strong long before anyone asked if they were safe. Families closed ranks. Churches urged forgiveness before truth. Communities protected reputations faster than children. Now those girls are women. They are leaders, mothers, partners, workers, pillars. They carry households, economies, and traditions. And beneath that strength sits a history that was never given language. This episode is not about blaming culture. It is about telling the truth our history avoided. Because what is never spoken does not disappear. It waits, it hardens, and it follows women into adulthood, shaping who they become long after childhood is supposed to be over. Chapter 1. What Was Never Said. In many Caribbean households, childhood is governed by rules that are rarely written down. You learn them by watching. You learn them by what happens when you cross a line. You learn them by how fast the room goes quiet. For girls, the first rule is simple. Do not talk too much. Do not question adults. Do not repeat what happens inside the house. Silence is framed as respect. Obedience is framed as love. This is not taught in one moment. It is taught over years. It is taught through tone, through looks, through consequences that arrive without explanation, a slap without warning, a shout that ends a conversation, a reminder that children are seen, not heard. We often describe Caribbean childhood as strict. That word softens really happening. Strictness suggests order. What many girls experienced was control. Control over their bodies. Control over their voices. Control over what could be named and what could never be said out loud. Pain, when it appeared, was rarely treated as a problem. It was treated as a test. If you cried, you were told to stop. If you asked why, you were told not to answer back. If something frightened you, you were told to be strong. Girls learned quickly that discomfort was not a reason to be protected. It was a reason to toughen up. Inside many homes, discipline was public, and explanation was private, if it came at all. Adults acted with authority, but not accountability. A child did not need to understand. A child needed to comply. Respectability sat at the center of this system. The family image mattered. How the household looked from the outside mattered. What neighbors thought mattered. What church members believed mattered. If harm threatened that image, the harm was hidden, not confronted, not named, hidden. Girls were taught that speaking could embarrass the family, that repeating stories could bring shame, that outsiders did not need to know what happened behind closed doors. Sometimes the silence was enforced gently, a warning, a reminder. Sometimes it was enforced violently. Either way, the lesson landed. Keep quiet or suffer more. Religion often reinforced this lesson. Many girls grew up hearing that endurance was holy, that obedience pleased God, that suffering without complaint built character. Forgiveness was taught early. Accountability was taught late, if at all. When harm came from within the family, it became even harder to name. Blood ties complicated everything. Loyalty blurred right and wrong. Protection of elders was prioritized over protection of children. If the person causing harm was respected, feared, or financially necessary, silence became non-negotiable. Girls learned to read the room before they learned to read books. They learned who could be questioned and who could not. They learned when to disappear emotionally to avoid making things worse. This emotional disappearance is rarely recognized as trauma. It does not leave bruises that outsiders can see. It leaves patterns. A girl who stops asking questions. A girl who flinches at raised voices. A girl who apologizes even when she has done nothing wrong. Adults often praise these girls. She is so mature, she is so well-behaved, she does not give trouble. No one asked why. In many households, harshness was justified as preparation. The world is hard, life is cruel. Better you learn now, better it comes from me than from strangers. This logic allowed harm to be reframed as love. It allowed adults to avoid self-examination. It allowed cycles to repeat. Girls were told that crying made them weak, that talking back made them rude, that questioning adults made them disrespectful. Respect became silence. Silence became survival. There was rarely language for emotional harm. Sadness was dismissed. Fear was ignored. Confusion was mocked. If a girl tried to explain how something made her feel, she was often shut down. Stop being dramatic. Stop making up things. You are too sensitive. Over time, she learned to mistrust her own reactions. If adults said nothing was wrong, then maybe nothing was wrong. If adults said she was exaggerating, then maybe she was. This gaslighting was not always intentional. Many caregivers repeated what they themselves were taught. Many believed they were doing the right thing. But intention does not erase impact. What matters is what the child absorbs. And what many girls absorbed was this: your feelings are inconvenient, your voice is dangerous, your safety is secondary to order. There were moments when girls tried to speak, a comment, a question, a quiet confession. Often those moments ended badly. They were dismissed, they were laughed at, they were punished. Sometimes they were met with anger, sometimes with silence that felt even colder. After enough failed attempts, many girls stopped trying. Silence became a skill. Reading moods became a survival tactic. Anticipating adult reactions became second nature. Girls learned to stay small, to stay agreeable, to stay alert. This did not happen in isolation. Communities reinforced it. Neighbors did not intervene. Teachers focused on obedience more than well-being. Churches preached submission more than protection. There were exceptions, but the pattern was strong enough to shape generations. We rarely framed this as trauma. Trauma was something that happened elsewhere, in wars, in disasters, in extreme situations. What happened in Caribbean homes was framed as normal, necessary, cultural. But normal does not mean harmless. When a child grows up believing her pain is not worth addressing, that belief does not stay in childhood. It becomes embedded. By adolescence, many girls had learned to lock parts of themselves away: curiosity, anger, vulnerability. They learned which emotions were acceptable and which were dangerous. Joy was allowed, but only within limits. Sadness was tolerated briefly, then discouraged. Anger was almost always punished, especially anger. An angry girl was labeled rude, uncontrolled, disrespectful, ungrateful. So girls swallowed it. They smiled instead. They helped more. They tried harder. Adults often mistook this compliance for health. They mistook quiet for stability. They mistook obedience for maturity. They did not see the cost because the cost was internal. This chapter of Caribbean history rarely appears in textbooks. It lives in memories, in body language, in unspoken rules passed down at dinner tables and family gatherings. It lives in the way many women still lower their voices when discussing childhood, in the pauses, in the phrases. That's just how it was. We survived. Survival became the benchmark. Not safety, not dignity, survival. But survival alone is a low standard for a child. As girls grew, their silence hardened into habit. Their emotional restraint became reflex. Their fear of speaking became instinct. By the time these girls reached adulthood, the silence was no longer imposed only from the outside. It had been internalized, and by then the most dangerous lesson had already settled in. By the time these girls learned how to speak, their bodies had already learned how not to. Chapter 2, Survival Becomes the Personality. By adolescence, the lessons of silence had already done their work. They no longer needed to be enforced every day. They lived inside the body, in posture, in tone, in what felt safe to reveal and what felt dangerous to name. Many Caribbean girls entered their teenage years already trained to manage adults, to scan moods, to predict reactions, to avoid conflict before it started. This skill was praised. She is sensible. She knows how to behave. She does not cause problems. What was rarely recognized is that this behavior was not confidence. It was vigilance. As girls moved into young adulthood, survival stopped being a response to childhood and became an identity. Strength was no longer something they did. It was who they were expected to be. Hyper-independence became a badge of honor. Do it yourself. Do not ask. Do not rely. Need is weakness. Dependence is danger. Many women learned early that asking for help came with consequences, judgment, ridicule, control. So they stopped asking, even when they were exhausted, even when they were overwhelmed. They learned to perform competence at all times, at school, at work, in relationships, in church. This competence often hid deep emotional shutdown. Feelings were managed privately, if at all. Vulnerability felt unsafe. Tears felt embarrassing. Anger felt forbidden. The body learned to hold tension quietly. The mind learned to compartmentalize. Survival showed up as people-pleasing, saying yes when the answer was no, smiling through discomfort, avoiding confrontation even when harm was present. Women were praised for being easy to work with, easy to live with, easy to rely on. Few asked what it cost to be so easy. Shame followed closely behind. Shame around emotional needs, shame around sexuality, shame around saying no, shame around not wanting what was expected. In many Caribbean cultures, women are taught to be desirable but not desiring, available but not demanding, strong but not angry, capable but not complicated. Any deviation risks labeling difficult, loose, unstable, ungrateful. So many women learn to shrink parts of themselves to stay acceptable. Survival also meant emotional numbness. When pain has nowhere to go, it settles. When feelings are repeatedly dismissed, they go quiet. Some women described feeling disconnected from themselves, like they were watching life instead of living it, doing what needed to be done without fully being there. This numbness was rarely named as harm. It was often mistaken for calm, for maturity, for balance. Resilience became a public performance. Caribbean women were celebrated for carrying everything: family responsibilities, financial pressure, emotional labor, community expectations. The praise was constant. She is strong. She can handle anything. She always finds a way. What was missing was permission to rest, permission to fall apart, permission to say this is too much. Strength became mandatory. Opting out was not an option. In workplaces, this survival mode translated into overachievement and overextension. Women took on more than their share. They avoided appearing weak. They tolerated disrespect longer than they should have. They worked twice as hard to be taken seriously and stayed quiet when lines were crossed. In relationships, survival often meant confusion. Love was mixed with endurance. Affection was tied to sacrifice. Conflict felt dangerous even when necessary. Some women stayed too long. Others kept distance to feel safe. Intimacy triggered alarms. The body remembered even when the mind did not. Trust was difficult. Letting someone see vulnerability felt like handing them a weapon. Religion sometimes reinforced these patterns. Messages about submission, forgiveness, and endurance continued into adulthood. Women were urged to pray harder, endure longer, and question themselves first. Rarely were they encouraged to question systems, or power, or harm disguised as duty. Community spaces often rewarded silence. Women who spoke openly about pain were labeled negative, bitter, disrespectful. Those who kept quiet were seen as dignified, graceful, God-fearing. Survival behaviors were not only internal, they were reinforced externally at every stage. Many women learned to intellectualize pain instead of feeling it, to analyze instead of grieve, to joke instead of cry. Humor became armor, productivity became proof of worth. When cracks appeared, they were handled privately, in bathrooms, in parked cars, late at night when no one was watching. Mental health language existed, but access was limited. Therapy was often stigmatized. Talking about emotional pain was still seen as unnecessary or indulgent. You are alive, you are functioning, what more do you want? This question hovered over many women's lives. Survival also shaped how women related to their own bodies. Ignoring discomfort became normal. Pushing through pain became routine. The body learned that signals could be overridden, fatigue ignored, stress normalized. This disconnect carried consequences that were rarely discussed openly. Yet from the outside, these women looked successful, capable, admired. Communities leaned on them. Families depended on them. Institutions benefited from their labor. Few paused to ask what happened when survival became permanent. The longer survival mode continued, the harder it became to imagine another way of being. Rest felt unfamiliar. Stillness felt unsafe. Slowing down triggered anxiety. Doing less felt like failure. Even joy could feel suspicious, as if something bad might follow. Many women carried an unnamed grief, not always for something specific, but for a version of themselves that never got to exist. A softer self, a louder self, a protected self. But grief had no clear outlet, so it stayed buried. What began as adaptation had become a prison, one that looked like success from the outside and exhaustion on the inside. Survival had kept them alive. It had helped them navigate systems that were not designed to protect them. But survival alone was not enough to sustain a life. What once saved them now demanded everything. What kept them alive now begins to cost them everything. Chapter 3, The Cost We Never Counted. By adulthood, many Caribbean women are no longer living under direct control. No one is standing over them with rules. No one is telling them to hush. No one is watching every move. And yet the system remains. It lives inside habits, inside reflexes, inside what feels safe and what feels forbidden. The silence learned in childhood does not disappear when a woman gains independence. It follows her into relationships, workplaces, churches, and homes of her own. In relationships, many women struggle to name needs without guilt. Wanting more feels like asking for too much. Expressing discomfort feels like starting trouble. Some women stay quiet to keep peace. Others leave before anyone gets close. Both are forms of protection learned early. Conflict feels dangerous even when it is healthy. Raised voices trigger shutdown. Disagreement feels like rejection. Love becomes something to manage instead of something to experience. At work, the patterns continue. Women take on excessive responsibility without complaint. They tolerate disrespect longer than necessary. They avoid asserting boundaries for fear of being labeled difficult. They overperform, overgive, overextend. Burnout is framed as weakness. Exhaustion is worn like a badge. Institutions benefit from this conditioning. Families rely on it. Communities expect it. Caribbean women are praised for holding everything together. Rarely are they asked, who is holding them? Motherhood adds another layer. Many women want to break cycles. They want to do better, be gentler, listen more. But unhealed silence has a way of leaking out. Some mothers struggle to sit with children's big emotions. Anger feels threatening. Tears feel overwhelming. They reach for the tools they were given because they were never shown alternatives. Others swing to the opposite extreme, overprotective, overinvolved, afraid to repeat harm, but unsure how to parent without fear. Both responses come from the same place, a childhood where safety was conditional. Intergenerational transmission is rarely intentional. It is structural, learned, embedded. Silence is passed down not through words, but through reactions, through what is ignored, through what is punished, through what is avoided. Communities often frame this as culture, tradition, discipline, but culture is not static, and tradition is not immune from critique. Across the Caribbean and the diaspora, quiet reckonings are happening. In kitchens, in whispered conversations, in late-night phone calls between women who trust each other enough to speak, stories are being shared, sometimes for the first time. Not always with anger, often with disbelief, with grief, with the realization that what felt personal was actually patterned. Many women are recognizing that strength was demanded before safety was offered, that endurance was praised because it was useful, that silence served systems more than it served children. This recognition is destabilizing. When silence is named as harm, not virtue, the ground shifts. Women begin to question what they accepted as normal. They revisit memories with new language. They see connections they were never allowed to see. This does not happen neatly. It is not linear. There is no clean resolution. Some relationships change, some end, some deepen painfully before healing, if healing comes at all. Communities resist. Pushback appears. Accusations of disrespect, of betrayal, of abandoning culture. Speaking up has consequences, but staying silent has consequences too. Many women carry physical symptoms linked to years of emotional suppression, chronic tension, fatigue, anxiety, disconnection from their bodies. They were taught to ignore signals. Now the signals are louder. Faith spaces are also being challenged. Women are questioning teachings that prioritize submission over safety, forgiveness over accountability. Some leave, some stay and push back, some create new spaces altogether. This too is part of the reckoning. The goal is not to paint Caribbean culture as uniquely harmful. Silence around harm exists everywhere. But specific histories matter. Colonial control, enslavement, economic precarity, religious authority. These forces shaped survival strategies that were necessary once and damaging later. Understanding this context does not excuse harm. It explains how it became normalized. What changes now is awareness. Women are refusing to be strong at the cost of themselves. They are questioning narratives that glorify suffering. They are naming harm even when it makes others uncomfortable. They are learning to speak without apology. This shift is uneven, risky, incomplete. Some women have more freedom than others. Class, location, and support matter. But the movement is real. It shows up in how women parent, in how they choose partners, in how they leave unsafe situations sooner, in how they talk to daughters differently. It shows up in refusing to laugh off pain, in saying no without explanation, in asking for help even when it feels unnatural. This is not softness, it is courage. It requires facing grief that was postponed for decades. It requires mourning childhoods that were survived, not protected. It requires standing in the discomfort of truth. Communities are being forced to listen, slowly, reluctantly, sometimes angrily. But the silence is cracking. And once silence breaks, it cannot be fully restored. The cost of childhood trauma carried into adulthood is not just individual suffering. It is collective. It shapes how families function, how love is expressed, how power is distributed. Naming it is not an attack on culture. It is an attempt to evolve it. The question facing Caribbean communities is not whether women are strong enough to endure more. They already have been. The question is whether strength will continue to be demanded as a substitute for safety. The question is whether silence will remain the inheritance we pass down. Because this pain does not disappear on its own. It waits, and now finally, women are deciding what happens next.